Today, Nicola Sturgeon, Alex Salmond, and an almighty scandal at the heart of Scottish politics. It's the 14th of November, 2014. Nicola Sturgeon is making her first speech as leader of the SNP party after taking over from her friend and mentor, Alex Salmond. Today,
without the guidance and support that Alec has given me over more than 20 years, it's unlikely that I would be standing here. I owe him a personal debt of gratitude, and it's important to me to put my thanks to him on the public record today.
It was an incredibly successful political partnership. An unstoppable partnership was how Alex Salmond described it in his referendum campaign diaries. Nicola Sturgeon has always described him as, you know, as close as family to her. She once said, "He believed in me long before I believed in myself."
Nicola Sturgeon may think back on those words very differently now. Alex Salmond has accused her of breaking the ministerial code over the way she handled claims of harassment against him in 2018. She dismisses Alex Salmond's accusations of a government plan to remove him from public life as wild conspiracy. Now there are calls for her to resign after explosive revelations emerged last night. Today, Nicola Sturgeon says she will give her side of the story to an inquiry that has revealed her SNP party is in turmoil just months before an election that they hope could secure them a second referendum on Scottish independence. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in focus, the unravelling of Scotland's greatest political partnership. Libby Brooks, you're The Guardian's Scotland correspondent, and you've reported on Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon for many years. Are they very similar people?
Well, they both believe passionately in Scottish independence. I think in terms of personality, they're very different creatures. I remember one aide who worked with both of them describing it like this, that after a big political event, Nicola Sturgeon goes home with either the sort of work papers for tomorrow or a novel, whilst Alex Salmond wants to have a curry and a carry out with an entourage of special advisers. And I think it is, you know, it's fair to say Salmond loves the spotlight. He's a brilliant debater. He relished being Alex Salmond, being First Minister of Scotland. I think Nicola Sturgeon has had to work a lot harder on her public confidence. Politically, there are differences between them too. Sturgeon has made no secret of being to the left of Salmond. And in fact, before 2014, she was known as the only person in the Holyrood cabinet who could disagree with him and get away with it.
Alex Salmond's place in history as one of Scotland's greatest leaders is secure, and rightly so. However, I have no doubt that he has a big contribution yet to make to politics in Scotland. I know that I will continue to seek his wise counsel.
The SNP have been in power in Scotland for over a decade, and the close relationship between Salmond and Sturgeon is seen as instrumental to the party's success. After Nicola Sturgeon became First Minister, did their relationship change?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably the balance of power in their relationship shifted significantly. Friends have spoken about how hard Alex Salmond found it to adjust. Got to remember, at that time, Nicola Sturgeon was travelling the country addressing these massive, adoring audiences following the huge influx of new members that happened after the referendum. She was enjoying rocketing approval ratings, and at the same time, Alex Salmond was back to being a backbencher. He then returned to Westminster in the SNP landslide of 2015. Lost his seat in 2017. Again, friends say that he blamed Sturgeon for a lacklustre election campaign. Tensions were continuing to grow, particularly around Alex Salmond's much more gung-ho approach to having a second independence referendum. And at this point, it's worth noting that there were a few other things brewing. The Scottish Government press team got an inquiry from Sky News about allegations of sexually inappropriate behaviour by Salmond at Edinburgh Airport. He denied any wrongdoing and nothing was broadcast at the time, but it raised suspicions, of course. And then in November, SNP MSP Mark MacDonald resigned as a Holyrood minister over sending sexually inappropriate text messages. And then Sturgeon instructed her officials to review procedures for dealing with bullying and harassment complaints against ministers.
As you say, Nicola Sturgeon decided to review harassment complaints against ministers. And this was at a time when many industries were experiencing a reckoning on sexual assault in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. How did this impact in Holyrood?
Nicola Sturgeon wanted to set up this new policy. She wanted to get it up and running quickly. And she specifically told the civil service that the new policy should apply to former ministers too. And around that time, as we now know, complaints of sexual harassment against Alex Salmond were lodged.
The complaints against Alex Salmond were made back in January, but news of this investigation only emerged last night. Today, he spoke out.
This was revealed in August 2018 when the story was leaked to the Daily Record, and the Record reported that these two female civil servants had come forward, detailed incidents of sexual harassment that they said were perpetrated by Alex Salmond, and the Scottish Government was investigating that.
I've made many mistakes, political mistakes, personal mistakes, I know that. But I am not guilty of harassing anyone, and I absolutely deny any suggestion of criminality.
And you've never sexually harassed anybody?
I've never sexually harassed anyone.
And how did Alex Salmond initially respond?
He immediately held a press conference in which he admitted that he had been no saint, as he put it, but he vigorously denied sexual harassment. The other thing that Salmond did was resign from the SNP, he said, because he wanted to avoid causing internal division. And then he announced that he had set up a crowdfunder to support his judicial review of the Scottish Government's handling of the allegations.
What is important is that complaints are treated seriously, regardless of who the person complained about is. I have been very clear about my belief in the importance of that, and that's a principle that cannot be applied selectively, no matter how difficult that might be for me, for my party, or for others.
That crowdfunder attracted double the initial target within 3 days. Thousands of people donated. It ended up totalling about £100,000. And I think that really underlines the loyalty that Salmond continues to command amongst both senior figures in the party and also rank and file independent supporters. And in a way that set the tone, I think, for what followed. I've no doubt that those people who donated believed passionately that he was being badly treated and needed their support. But I know that many women's groups at the time had their head in their hands, because what message did that send to other women about what happens when you make a complaint about a powerful man?
Alex Salmond continued to deny the allegations and actually decided to take the government to court over this in a case that concluded in January 2019. What happened in that case?
Well, Alex Salmond was successful.
In light of the full explanations tendered by counsel to the court this morning on behalf of the parties to these proceedings, I will now proceed to make the orders which are necessary to give effect to the agreed resolution of the case.
The Scottish Government lawyers admitted that a senior human resources official who'd been overseeing the investigation had actually spoken to the two complainants before the investigation began, which was obviously a complete breach of process. The court found that it actually made the investigation unlawful. They said it was tainted by apparent bias, and he was awarded more than £500,000 in legal costs.
They were taken in circumstances which were procedurally unfair, and in respect that they were tainted by apparent bias.
This then was a big and costly loss for the Scottish Government, but this story was far from over. Police Scotland had been investigating the allegations against Alex Salmond, and in January 2019, he was charged with 14 sexual offences. You covered his trial for The Guardian in March last year. Tell me what happened.
That Police Scotland investigation was actually triggered by the decision by Leslie Evans, the Permanent Secretary of the Scottish Government, to send the results of their internal inquiry to the police. although obviously the outcome of the judicial review didn't have any impact on the trial itself.
He's Scotland's former First Minister, now on trial, accused of sex crimes. Alex Salmond denies the 14 charges against him.
In court, Alex Prentice, who was summing up the case for the prosecution, told the jury that he believed Salmond was a sexual predator who exploited his power to prey on younger, more junior women. He said, "This isn't about a plot or a political conspiracy. This is about a powerful man who abused his power to satisfy his sexual desires with impunity."
Day one of his trial, heard from one of 10 women accusers. The former Scottish Government official, known as Woman H, told how she was alone with him inside Bute House, the First Minister's official residence.
The court heard from a number of witnesses who said that Salmond's behaviour had led to an unofficial ban on him working alone with female civil servants at Bute House late at night. And after one junior official accused Salmond of forcing her onto a bed in December 2013, which was a charge that Salmond denied, saying that the pair had had a sleepy cuddle, the jury heard that instead of an investigation, civil service officials and Salmond's most senior aide brokered a private apology from the First Minister for her.
How did Alex Salmond defend himself?
Salmond denied all of their allegations. He described them variously as reinterpretations, exaggerations, or in some cases, deliberate fabrications for political purposes. He did tell his lawyer, Gordon Jackson QC, that with hindsight, he wished he'd been more careful with people's personal space. Gordon Jackson sort of said to the jury there were no direct witnesses to the alleged assaults, that there were inconsistencies and contradictions in terms of how the women sort of described the events. And he told the jury, "This comes out of a political bubble with no real independent support of any kind. I've said already it smelt, and I don't apologise for that one bit. It's the same pattern over and over again. It's scary."
Tonight on Reporting Scotland, Alex Salmond has been cleared of sexually assaulting 9 women while he was Scotland's First Minister.
Salmond was acquitted of all charges of sexual assault. The jury found him not guilty on 12 charges of attempted rape, sexual assault and indecent assault after about 6 hours of deliberation. And they also came to the uniquely Scottish verdict of not proven on one charge of sexual assault with intent to rape. After the verdict, there were immediate recriminations. Salmond's allies took the verdicts as evidence that there had been an overarching conspiracy, which they believed was sort of organised by prominent officials in Nicola Sturgeon's office and the leadership of the SNP.
During that trial and then after it, did we hear very much from Nicola Sturgeon?
Obviously, Sturgeon didn't really sort of engage with the trial as it was taking place. You know, she was unable to comment on ongoing legal proceedings. When the verdicts came through, she said that they must be respected, but she added that her focus was currently on steering the country through the coronavirus crisis.
And what did Alex Salmond say at the end of the trial?
Well, he thanked his legal team, but immediately he went on to issue what was, you know, essentially a warning aimed very squarely at those who he believed had wronged him. He said, "As many of you will know, there was certain evidence
I would like to have seen led in this trial, but for a variety of reasons we were not able to do so. At some point, that information, that facts and that evidence will see
the light of day." And so it was very clear that when the coronavirus pandemic had abated, this issue was going to return to the very top of the political agenda.
OK, Libby, so we've had this initial government investigation, which ends up being ruled unlawful, a victory for Alex Salmond. And then he goes on trial and is found not guilty. But now this story has very much returned to the top of the agenda in Scottish politics. Why? What has happened?
So there are now 2 ongoing investigations as a result of this. Firstly, Nicola Sturgeon referred herself under the ministerial code because there were questions around meetings that she had with Alex Salmond whilst the original government inquiry was underway. This investigation was passed to James Hamilton, a former director of public prosecutions in Ireland, and he is expected to deliver his report sometime in March. Secondly, the Scottish Parliament appointed a special committee to investigate the government's handling of the original inquiry and also Sturgeon's actions. That's a committee made up of cross-party MSPs. And again, there is an expectation that they will deliver their report before Parliament rises for the election recess, which will be at the end of March. But time is really running out for them.
Last Friday, Alex Salmond appeared in front of the parliamentary committee investigating the government after a number of delays and legal wranglings. What was behind all of this?
Well, Rachel, I mean, he almost didn't appear because of this ongoing row about the evidence that he wanted to submit to the inquiry, which he said was key to his allegations that Nicola Sturgeon broke the ministerial code, and also setting out why he believes that there was a malicious plan, as he puts it, orchestrated by people close to Sturgeon, including her husband, Peter Murrell, the chief executive of the SNP, and Leslie Evans, head of the civil service, to destroy his reputation. And he said even put him in prison. And his concern was that if this evidence wasn't published in full, then he wouldn't be able to refer to it when he gave evidence in person. But some MSPs on the committee, and indeed eventually the Crown Office itself, had concerns that this evidence was going to identify complainers in the original trial. This back and forth can be very difficult to report, but really, at the core of it are questions about who is protecting whom. When the Parliament decided that it would publish this evidence, the chief executive of Rape Crisis Scotland immediately wrote to Holyrood's presiding officer seeking urgent reassurances. She said that he would be protecting the anonymity of the complainers. Those who want the evidence published, they insisted that they would be protected. But meanwhile, you've got Salmond and his allies accusing the Crown Office of essentially suppressing evidence that would damage the Scottish government.
OK, so he did eventually appear then on Friday. How did he come across, and did he have more evidence for this so-called government plot against him?
It really was a marathon evidence session, 6 hours. As you can imagine, it was hugely hyped. And, you know, it was extraordinary just for the fact, I think, rather than the detail, that you've got the former First Minister of Scotland sitting in the Scottish Parliament accusing those close to the current First Minister of essentially conspiring to destroy him, his reputation, and bring him down.
For 2 years and 6 months, this has been a nightmare. This committee has been blocked and tackled at every turn with calculated and deliberate suppression of key evidence.
He accused Sturgeon of multiple breaches of the ministerial code. He said that Leslie Evans, James Wolfe and Peter Murrell should consider their positions. He even suggested that weak leadership of Scotland's institutions could undermine the case for independence.
The Scottish civil servant hasn't failed. Its leadership has failed. The Crown Office hasn't failed. Its leadership has failed. Scotland hasn't failed. Its leadership has failed.
In terms of this conspiracy, and it should be said that Salmond worked very hard not to use the word conspiracy, he said that this plan was evidenced by a number of different elements, including the timing of the decision to extend the new harassment policy to include former ministers. He also said that this malicious plan was evidenced by the government's refusal to let the committee see the legal advice that it was given for the judicial review, despite, in fact, 2 votes that there have been in Holyrood demanding that it do so. And this advice is said to have warned the government that it was likely to lose Salmond's legal challenge. Salmond claims that Sturgeon knew about this and pressed on regardless, which would, of course, be another breach of the ministerial code.
I've got no doubt that Nicola has broken the ministerial code, but it's not for me to suggest what the consequences should be. It's for the people who are judging that, including this committee.
And then, Libby, last night, that previously secret legal advice you've told us about was released, and it contains some explosive revelations, didn't it? Today, Nicola Sturgeon will tell her side of the story when she appears before the inquiry. What will they want to ask her about?
Well, you're right, Rachel. We had this really dramatic flurry of publications on Tuesday evening, and more detail emerged specifically around the legal advice, basically about when the Scottish Government knew that its legal battle, this judicial review with Alex Salmond, was likely to fail, that it was warned by its own lawyers months before it finally conceded and pushed ahead anyway. We've seen emails with Scottish Government lawyers saying that, raising sort of extreme concerns about the investigating officer in the inquiry had actually met and counselled the two women who brought forward complaints before they formally lodged those complaints. As well, on Tuesday evening, there was also some witness statements that pertain to the timing of when Nicola Sturgeon first learnt about these original sexual harassment allegations. On the 29th of March in 2018, Nicola Sturgeon had a meeting with Salmond's former chief of staff, Jeff Aberdeen, in her Holyrood office. And she's since described that meeting as fleeting, and in fact said that she'd initially forgotten about it. But Salmond, Aberdeen, and now two other witnesses say the inquiry into these allegations was actually discussed at that meeting 4 days earlier than Sturgeon says she first knew about them. And those witnesses also say that the name of one of the complainers was revealed to Aberdeen, which is, of course, a complete breach of process and privacy. Also, in the witness statements that came out last night, we had information about a meeting between Sturgeon and Salmond at Sturgeon's home on the 2nd of April, so just a few days after that meeting in her Holyrood office. Now, she originally told Holyrood and the media that this was the first time that she had learnt that he was facing these allegations of sexual misconduct. Salmond also alleged that Sturgeon at that meeting had left him in no doubt that she was going to intervene in the complaints process on his behalf. Now, Sturgeon has denied this, but yesterday evening we had a letter from Salmond's lawyer, Duncan Hamilton, who says that he was also in the room and repeated Salmond's versions of events. It's important to note that those witnesses could all be described as Salmond allies. And I also appreciate, you know, it may seem trivial arguing about a matter of days between these meetings, but it's really key to whether Sturgeon thought that this was government or SNP business. And thus that speaks to whether she broke the ministerial code by failing to record it as such or to inform the appropriate people about it. So these last minute revelations really add to the already intense pressure on Nicola Sturgeon as she prepares to give evidence this morning.
This sounds pretty bad for Nicola Sturgeon, Libby. Is there a chance she might have to resign?
Well, we've already seen the Scottish Conservatives making a call for her resignation on the back of these latest revelations. I think she is going to be under intense pressure, and I think everything depends on what kind of account she gives of herself and her actions and her government's actions today.
Coming up, what does all of this mean for the SNP ahead of elections in May? And could it threaten their hopes for an independent Scotland? Libby, this is an extraordinary story and a huge row between two big figures in Scottish politics. And it comes at a crucial time for the SNP. They've got elections coming up in May. How damaging could this scandal be for the party and for the independence movement in Scotland?
Well, I mean, I guess we'll know the immediate political cost in 2 months' time at the Holyrood elections. There's been a lot of discussion about whether this row is cutting through to voters, but I think it is inevitable that these high-profile evidence sessions are going to have a greater impact on the public. We know that the SNP needs to win a majority at Holyrood to show that it's got a mandate to pursue a second independence referendum with Westminster. Most recent polling shows that there has been a slight dip in support both for the SNP and for independence. And I guess the question is sort of how much of that is connected to the current row? How much of that is connected to the fact that more people are getting vaccinated and there's perhaps sort of greater optimism, sort of people coming out of the pandemic and thinking maybe the last thing that we need is another referendum? I don't know. It's very hard to pin down at the moment.
It is very interesting, the timing of all of this. Alex Salmond dedicated his life to gaining independence for Scotland. And it's something that Nicola Sturgeon, of course, is dedicated to now. Why has he picked this particular moment to raise this case and to challenge her leadership and to challenge the credibility of the SNP in such a public way, do you think?
I think that Alex Salmond is very angry, very disappointed, hurt by the way that he feels he has been treated. When I speak to SNP activists, I think it is fair to say that there is a real generational divide. Obviously, there are older people who are more familiar with his historical impact on the movement. But at the same time, there are these sort of younger folk, many of whom came in after 2014, after he had stopped leading the party, for whom he is yesterday's man. I can remember one senior SNP activist telling me just before the trial that they felt there'd always been an element in the SNP that says, don't criticise, keep your eye on independence, we're not good at owning our mistakes. And I think that's really key now, sort of whether activists feel that the SNP is owning its mistakes.
More widely, Nibby, in thinking back to the original accusations that led us here in the first place, what do you think all of this means for the Me Too movement in Scotland?
In the spring of last year, I remember suggesting that regardless of the outcome of the trial, this could be Scotland's Me Too moment, because it would spark conversations not about Salmond versus Sturgeon, but more widely discussions about power, responsibility, what's acceptable, how to stop it when it's not. And I was really wrong. During and since the trial, the women involved have faced an onslaught of abuse and threats, mainly online, although at the time of the trial they were issued with personal alarms by the police, and people threatening them and even naming them online is still going on today. In fact, in a very unusual move, just after the verdicts, and I think reflecting the frustration that they felt at being characterised as co-conspirators, they released a joint statement a week after the verdicts in which they described the trial as devastating. And recently, some of them have issued a similar statement criticising the inquiry after some of their private messages about the case were released to MSPs. I think that Scotland has gone backwards over the past year. I see it in the public discourse that has embraced descriptions of witch hunts and covens and conspirators like it's the mid-1600s, where retrograde theories about women lying and making up sexual assault allegations have more traction now, where a court order to protect sexual assault complainers is treated with hostility in some quarters as though there were no wider principle at stake. I see it in the increasing violence of online discourse in particular. There was a recent survey that found that a third of female MSPs have received at least one threat of sexual violence. You know, just after I started reporting from Holyrood in 2015, there were three female leaders of the three main parties, and there was a gender balanced cabinet. This was a parliament that was supposed to be doing things differently, and it has manifestly failed to do so in this case. Now, there can be no polling on the wider impact on women or their willingness to report harassment or assaults, but I've been reporting for 20 years on women's experience of sexual harassment and assault, and I know what it takes for an individual to come forward. And because of the failings on every side at every point in this saga, I fear that it is now harder for women to do so in Scotland.
Libby, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rachel.
That was Libby Brooks. Read all of her reporting on this at theguardian.com, where there are also some very helpful explainers that can give you even more detail about this story. That's it for today. Before we go, I just wanted to thank everyone who has left a review for us recently and given us feedback on the Freshwater series. We love hearing from you. Today's episode was produced by Sammy Kent and Rhys Storer. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.